Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the fourth program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation today is called Constitutional Crisis. Call it what you will, this is not normal. Many of us are not yet feeling the heat from dramatic policy changes coming out of the federal administration. For many of us, life goes on. But some of us are getting hurt, and some of us are actually afraid because so many of these federal policies are being promulgated by executive order without Congress and sometimes in defiance of the courts. Some observers are concerned that our country is experiencing a constitutional crisis. It is certainly a moment of disruption. How serious is it? Who might be next? How is this moment outside the norm? And how worried should we be here in Maine? This show was pre-recorded on April 15th. You can send your comments to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests. Samuel Bagenstos is the Frank G. Millard Professor of Law at the University of Michigan, where he specializes in civil rights, labor and employment law, health law, and governance. Welcome, Samuel. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Dennett is the Program Director at the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. Thanks for coming on, Ryan.
Glad to be here.
Lauren McCauley is the editor of the Maine Morning Star. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Amy Weishart is president of Maine Library Association. Thanks for joining us, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get started. We've been producing the Democracy Forum locally on WERU since 2004. We have dozens and dozens of shows under our belt. Our show this month has been the most difficult to produce in our long experience. This is the first time in 20 years that Maine people have been afraid to come on the program and criticize the federal administration for fear of retribution that would affect their ability to continue fulfilling their mission. In some cases, that mission being to protect and provide for the most vulnerable among us. We know that something is not normal just from that. So I want to thank our guests for their courage in coming forward today to tell us their stories. And I'm going to start with you, Samuel. Let me put it to you first. What are the most concerning things that you see happening right now?
Well, I think, you know, as we speak today, the most concerning thing is, you know, the set of statements that the president and his administration have made just this week about the Abrego-Garcia case out of Maryland, where, you know, the administration acknowledged that it sent someone erroneously to a prison in El Salvador and was ordered by a court to take steps to get him back and treat it as if they had not made that error, including being told by the Supreme Court to do that. And yet you have the Justice Department, the Homeland Security Department, all the way up to the president making light of that order, at the very least slow walking that order, suggesting they might defy it and not bring this person back. I think that is incredibly dangerous for everyone, particularly given the degree of vindictiveness and the retaliatory behavior we've seen from this administration toward people who oppose the administration or might stand as an independent voice. So to me, that's number one. It's sort of wrapping all in one package, you know, all of the great concerns that we've seen for this few months of this administration.
How outside the norm is this? Like, can we remember this or even beyond memory? Has this ever happened before?
No, I mean, this is really beyond the pale, what we have here. You know, this assertion of a power to arrest somebody, send them to another country, to a prison in another country that we are, by the way, paying for, and then to say, but now that they're in another country, there's nothing I can do about it, and there's nothing a court can do to make me do anything about it. That is just an incredibly dangerous power for any administration to assume. And that is not something that has a parallel in our history.
Do you remember in Trump 1 when the White House was routinely violating the Hatch Act and others, and Kellyanne Conway sort of stood up and said, I think this is a direct quote, like, who's going to make me? Yeah, we're doing it. We're violating the law. Who's going to stop us? So how are checks and balances performing in this moment, Samuel?
Not super well, I think, is the answer. So I think we've seen that attitude that you describe, which was a theme of the first Trump administration, has become the dominant theme of the second Trump administration. The idea that there are no limits that Congress can impose on the presidency. So, you know, we see the refusal to spend money that Congress has appropriated, the unilateral destruction, feeding to the wood chipper of agencies that were created by Congress. You see this playing fast and loose with judicial orders, where judges have said, no, 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 you're violating the law. You have to send out the money that Congress has appropriated. You cannot withhold it anymore. And yet somehow the Trump administration continues not to spend the money. You see this, as I said, vindictive behavior where anyone who would stand up to the administration, as your own governor has seen, is treated with the withholding of federal funds on which the state or other entity relies. You know, all of this is just an incredibly dangerous set of actions to engage in.
Lauren, I see you nodding, and Maine is in the crosshairs in this moment. Can you talk a little bit about the situation that we here in Maine in particular find ourselves in?
You know, if you remember back to February when Governor Mills was at the National Governors Conference, she was at the White House, and President Trump specifically called her out. He was talking about the issue of, you know, transgender students in sports, and asked her if she was going to change state law per his executive order on the matter. And she said, no, I will follow state and federal law. And he said, I am the federal law. And she told him she'd see him in court. And since that moment, the state has been, you know, witness to what it means to stand up to the president like that. We've been subject to several investigations from different agencies, Health and Human Services, Department of Education, into our State Department of Education. And they all, you know, were, you know, a matter of days, no interviews, you know, we're not following the normal procedure, determined Maine to be in violation of Title IX. And then in addition to those investigations, there's also been these myriad cuts and other retaliatory actions coming from the federal government. You know, most recently we had the USDA shoot off this note to the governor saying they were going to cut funding that helps disperse school meals for children. And actually late Friday, we had our Friday news dump. A judge, it was the first ruling in this, what I think of as Trump v. Maine, said, no, you can't just cut those funds, you know, without an investigation, without any finding. So they, you know, they certainly weren't ruling on the Title IX issue, which is destined for the courts right now. But it was sort of validating this idea that the federal government is taking retaliatory action against the state, not following due process, and just trying to muscle its way into every policy, basically.
So Ryan, the food and the farmers is kind of where you and your constituents come in. Talk a little bit about what's happened among your members.
Well, they can certainly share in the experience of having funds frozen, and even when, you know, the funds are need to be unfrozen, we get that news, we get excited, and the money doesn't move. And that has direct impacts, but also a growing loss of trust in the government. So even when contracts are paid, farmers aren't sure if they want to move forward with a new project because they don't have any faith that they'll be paid for those projects. And we're certainly seeing ripple effects of what farmers will invest in using those cost share programs that have been around for a long time, also holding off anticipating tariffs. And we're also seeing on the consumer end of things. I was just talking to a food distributor this morning who said that she is already seeing a decrease in sales across a wide variety of accounts. And they were telling me that in all the recent prior crises we've experienced, they haven't seen such a broad decline in sales the way that they're seeing it right now. So just like the broad nature of how it's being felt.
So would you say those declines in sales have to do with a loss of consumer confidence? Is that what you're talking about?
That seemed to be what she was indicating. I think that, you know, it's anecdotal in nature, but I think there's just a shared feeling across the board of uncertainty that there's these individual actions that are having direct impact, but there's just like this compound effect from all of it stacking up.
And talk a little bit, you referenced the cost sharing programs that farmers engage in. How did those work and what kind of projects were farms able to do with those programs that they may not be able to do anymore?
Sure. There's a number of different programs. One really popular one through the United States Department of Agriculture Natural Resource Conservation Service, NRCS, is a number of conservation practices that have been around since just after the Dust Bowl, because we as the broad community understand that we need to conserve our water and soil. And so we need to incentivize farmers using those practices because they're not always cost effective in the short term. So they have cost share programs where farmers sign a contract, they put forth the money to do mulching, have a nutrient management plan for spreading their manure so that they don't contaminate local watersheds. They do the work, they pay the vendors for the work, and then the NRCS pays them for part of that work, often like a 75% cost share. So 13 million last year was awarded in contracts funded by the Inflation Reduction Act. So that was new money coming in on top of the Farm Bill funding of this program. And all of those funds were frozen for a number of months. So there were farmers in the position of having already spent $40,000. I've heard of a story of $90,000. And their vendors, a lot of vendors being involved in doing technical assistance or excavation work. And the farmers are left without that funding to pay local vendors. So it does have a ripple effect in the local economy.
Okay, but so the farmer made the $90,000 investment expecting a $70,000 reimbursement. And now mm-hmm. they're stuck with the bill without the reimbursement.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Yeah. And then so even when farmers finally do get paid months later, some of them are still waiting. Farmers who have new contracts for these projects that they're wanting to do are like, I don't know if I want to put myself in that position.
Again, right. Loss of confidence. Mm-hmm. Samuel, are others, I want to talk to you too, Amy, but I just want to ask Samuel for a second. Are other states feeling it the way Maine is, or do you think Maine has been hit especially hard by this?
I think Maine has been targeted for, you know, retaliatory action by the president, certainly. But I think the story that you just heard from Ryan is a story that we've heard all around the country with this, you know, very capricious cutting off of federal funding. So, you know, I've heard of farmers in Michigan, farmers all over the country who have made investments based on the expectation that farm programs that they are a part of will pay for them because they have signed contracts. And then because of the actions of Elon Musk and the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, they've shut off, the federal government has shut off those payments. You know, that's not necessarily a part of the retaliatory action that President Trump has taken against the state of Maine. That's part of this more general refusal to spend money that Congress has appropriated that we have seen across the federal government right now, which is itself, you know, an unconstitutional assertion of power. Congress has the power of the purse. That is one of the fundamental powers of Congress going back to the founding of this country and even before. And we have an executive that has decided it does not need to follow Congress's decisions about what programs to fund. And it's causing real harm to real people like farmers all across the country.
I'm going to take a quick station break. Then I want to hear Amy's story from the libraries. And then I want to talk more about the Impoundment Control Act. So you're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is constitutional crisis. Call it what you will, this is not normal. Our guests this afternoon are Ryan Dennett, the program director at Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, Lauren McCauley, editor of the Maine Morning Star, Amy Weishart, president of the Maine Library Association, and Samuel Bagenstos, the Frank G. Miller Professor of Law at the University of Michigan. We were talking before the break about whose funding has been hit here in Maine, and I know libraries are in the crosshairs. Amy, what's happened among your constituents?
In Maine, we receive about $1.5 million in federal money that goes directly to the Maine State Library, and that represents about 30% of the Maine State Library's budget. So it's a small, very, very small portion of the federal budget, of course. Total funding for libraries across the entire federal government is 0.003% of the federal budget. And so the federal government disperses funds to each state. But in Maine, those funds are really vital to maintaining the infrastructure for libraries. So the Maine State Library provides resource sharing services. They provide digital resources. They provide services for people who live in really rural communities that might not be served by a library. Visually impaired people get direct services. So really underserved people in Maine. And also they connect small and rural libraries to resources in larger libraries and weave the fabric of library support throughout Maine. So the loss of federal funding for libraries, what has happened, as Samuel was discussing, the funds for fiscal year 25 have been congressionally appropriated. That's congressional purview. They've been approved, and Maine, and along with all of the other states, have not received the funding. And so just last week, the Maine State Library, because they have not received this $1.5 million in federal funds that have been approved by Congress, they decided they had to cut all 13 positions that were federally funded in their budget. So they cut 30% of their workforce. Immediately, they closed to the public. They have to completely restructure. We are still not sure exactly what services will be impacted because they have to go through a whole HR union process and figure out which jobs they reallocate, who actually, you know, will still have a job. And so it's created this chaos and confusion, a lot of disruption. It's absolutely the opposite of efficiency, clearly. And for each individual library now that receives services from the state, we're all just wondering what will the new reality be. And again, the funding is held up in the courts. So there are two lawsuits pending now. So potentially the federal funds could still be released, but we really are not sure at this point.
I have heard that some of that money supported interlibrary loan, which I know a lot of people in Maine use. Is that true?
Yes. Yep, it supports the staffing that administers the interlibrary loan. So if that goes away, the question is, yeah, how could we maintain that service that is really essential for resource sharing throughout the state? Because if you're in a tiny little library and you can request a book from any library across the state, that's a huge opportunity. And if that's gone, then people in rural areas will be disproportionately affected.
Okay, so the guardrails. I've read Michael Podhoretzer, some of you may know, who says the courts are not going to save us. What do you think, Samuel? I know there's a lot of litigation pending, but there's also, at least on Michael's part, Michael Podhoretzer's part, a lot of skepticism that the Supreme Court is really going to step up.
I think that's a very fair question. Right now, the only people who are really stepping up who have any power are the courts. You know, we have not seen Congress stepping up. Often these are congressional powers that the president is trampling over. So again, the congressional power of the purse. I mean, this is the very first power given to Congress in Article I of the Constitution, the power to spend money for the general welfare. Article 2 of the Constitution does not give the president his own spending power. It gives him a duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and it's Congress that passes the laws. And, you know, this is a congressional power and a legislative power that goes back even before the beginning of our Constitution. You know, it is the power that the British Parliament seized from the king in the Glorious Revolution of 1688. I mean, so this is, you know, one of the most fundamental building blocks of American constitutional government, and it's a congressional power, but Congress is not standing up. And so the question is, who will? There have been a number of judges who have issued orders telling the president and the administration that they need to spend the money Congress has appropriated. The administration has slow walked these orders. It has complied with some. It has, you know, played cute with others. It has not openly defied any of the orders about spending of money. Although, you know, it is interesting that in many of these cases, the administration has been told you have to spend the money, and yet they keep finding ways of not doing it. And it really will be up to the Supreme Court to stand up. Do we have reason to expect the Supreme Court will? You know, I think the jury is still out on that, but this is a court that is very favorable to executive power when Republican presidents are in office. It's a court that has been very favorable to Donald Trump personally, as we saw from the immunity case last summer, as we saw from the insurrection case, you know, overriding state efforts to throw Donald Trump off the ballot. And as we saw in the first Trump administration, when the court did invalidate some actions that the Trump administration took, but also seemed to bend over backwards to find ways of upholding actions that were very questionable, like the Muslim ban. So I think skepticism is entirely appropriate as to what the Supreme Court will do. But we're seeing right now, particularly with the Abrego-Garcia case, which is why I mentioned it, an instance where you have Donald Trump really coming close to thumbing his nose at the Supreme Court. I mean, the Supreme Court did say that the president and his administration have an obligation to facilitate the return of this individual from El Salvador and treat him as if he would have been treated if he had not been erroneously sent to a prison in another country. And I don't think any of us could watch those clips from the Oval Office yesterday where President Trump and President Bukele were essentially laughing at the Supreme Court and say, that is showing respect for the court. I think if the court has respect for itself, it will do something to insist that its orders be followed. But, you know, I totally get the skepticism, and it is very warranted based on the experience we've had both in this administration and in the previous Trump administration.
So, Amy and Ryan, are your organizations involved in, or are your constituents involved in litigation challenging the defunding that has happened in your various respective areas?
We are not directly involved in the litigation. We've been working with our congressional delegation, but they've kind of reached the point where, yeah, it's now shifted to the courts. The Maine Attorney General is part of the lawsuit, along with many other states, though.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Ryan?
We're not part of a lawsuit for the program that I just described. We are a partner on a Climate Smart Commodities program, which is actually sort of a repackaging of those long offered conservation practices to try to reach an underserved audience. So we're part of a $55 million grant project that a partner organization in Pennsylvania, PASA, they were the lead on it, and they are litigating the freezing of those funds.
Lauren, are you in a position to just give us a short rundown of some of the other lawsuits that are pending in Maine?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So I was trying to cross-reference with the Attorney General's site, because I think our Attorney General, Aaron Frey, I think he's joined on to like 8 or 9 of these like big coalition lawsuits that are happening. Some are about, you know, the various cuts and mass firings. I think it was 2 weeks ago, the Health and Human Services came out with billions of dollars in cuts, and that's having an impact. That one includes like all of the staff that administer LIHEAP funds, for instance. LIHEAP.
Okay, so yeah. Just for our listeners, explain who LIHEAP helps and what it does.
Yes, so this is the Low Income Heating Assistance Program. And, this is just one of so many cuts and actions that has happened. But, you know, essentially, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had rescinded his COVID era funding, that billions of dollars in COVID era funding that was given to states. And among the casualties of those cuts is all 20 staff members that administer these really essential funds. There's tens of thousands of Maine households that get this heating assistance. And Aaron Frey is part of the lawsuit that's countering that. You know, there's some that were, you know, targeting groups for having, you know, DEI principles, you know, and I think he's part of one of the mass suits against that. There's several other coalitions that are going against the Trump administration for various immigration policies. There's many, many, many lawsuits happening. And in some ways, it's made it very hard to track what's actually happening, because as Amy and Ryan mentioned in, you know, their tellings, it's like all of a sudden the check just doesn't come, or that then maybe, you know,
or the website goes down, or whatever.
The website goes down. Right. It's like the chaos is a key feature of this moment. And what we're trying to do as a news outlet is really try to track like what's actually happening, not just what someone says is happening, but to hear like the true impacts. And, you know, I think it's important that so much of this is being challenged in the courts, but it certainly makes it hard to understand. I think the Trump administration is truly just throwing everything at the wall and see what sticks. And, you know, attorney generals are doing their best to stop that where they're able, but it's hard to track.
And I mean, you mentioned LIHEAP, and, you know, Amy has talked about small rural hospitals. I've heard that food bank programs are being effective. I mean, does it seem like, I'm not sure who's going to answer this, but does it seem like some of the constituencies that are being hit the hardest are the ones that can afford it the least?
Absolutely. And, you know, I know we're focused right now on sort of these mass cuts happening on the executive branch, but if Congress passes the budget that they're poised to pass right now, they're going to be cutting Medicaid funding by a third. You know, that's going to hit the most marginalized Americans. I think that we are only beginning to get a sense of the impacts that will, you know, reach everyday folks.
Yeah. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Lauren McCauley, whom you just heard, editor of the Maine Morning Star, Amy Weishart, president of the Maine Library Association, Samuel Bainstoss, who is the Frank G. Millard Professor of Law at the University of Michigan, and Ryan Dennett, Program Director at the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. Our topic today is constitutional crisis. Call it what you will, this is not normal. This show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. I mean, let's talk a little bit about Congress, because in the sort of checks and balances, you know, Congress should be standing up for its own standing as an institution, as a third co-equal branch of government. I know some of you have been working with your congressional delegation in an effort to try to preserve the funding that you've lost. How's that working? I mean, you talked about that, Amy. Do you feel free to comment?
Sure. Yeah. So I will say all four members of our congressional delegation in Maine are very supportive of libraries. It's a bipartisan coalition, of course. And so they have, you know, all four of them have spoken out in different ways. The four of them also wrote a letter together last week and directed it to the acting head of IMLS, who was appointed by the president just a couple of weeks ago. Really, you know, strongly worded, telling him to release funds to Maine and to all of the other states. And certainly they've been very receptive. We've been calling, talking with them. My sense is that typically that would be effective, but in this situation, as far as I know, there was no response to that letter. There just has not been a lot of movement in terms of, you know, they're doing what they can, but I'm not really sure what more they can do. And that has been a big challenge to have that support. And yet it doesn't seem to be moving the needle.
What about you, Ryan? Has there been work among the congressional delegation to try to restore some of the farming money?
I would say that we've had a very similar experience. We've been sending sort of weekly updates to our delegation to make sure they're aware, and they've been very, very receptive, wanting to know details about what grants or programs are frozen so they can look into it for us. You know, they're doing that on their part. I don't think that they're getting a lot of quick answers. So it does feel a little bit stalled.
Samuel, it sort of seems kind of piecemeal, like each delegation is trying to deal with little bits of funding in their own state, but nobody's really standing up and say, whoa, wait, impoundment control, right?
I think that's right in a significant way. I mean, I will say in Maine, you all have the appropriations chair as one of your senators who is in the best possible position to be advocating for this. And the fact that she is not getting traction here is really notable and quite shocking. I think we are in a moment where it is the courts that are being asked to do this, but it really should be Congress, not just through ordinary constituent service, but through the more aggressive tools of oversight that they have. They should be demanding that people in the executive branch come to testify, provide documents under subpoena if necessary. And we're not seeing that. And it's probably not a huge surprise. I think that over the past few decades, our separation of powers has really eroded to the point where you don't see Congress really standing up for itself as a separate branch so much as you see people in Washington sort themselves into parties. And so the fact that Congress is controlled by the same party as the executive means we're seeing a lot less oversight. But I think that's a real loss for our constitutional system. Our system is really built on the idea, you know, that comes from Madison of ambition checking ambition. And right now, we're not seeing that. And so we're seeing a steady erosion of the power of Congress, which is the most democratic branch, to the president. And that is deeply concerning for our constitutional system.
Mm-hmm. Lauren, we talked a little bit about some of the constituencies that are getting hit, but I know there's been a ton of reporting in Maine about where else some of these cuts have come. Can you just give us a little bit of a summary about the other defunding initiatives?
You know, I really think of the cuts that have come to Maine as being in two buckets. You know, one is this one that's related to the retaliation and the Title IX stuff. And then one is these, you know, cuts that all of the states are experiencing. If we're thinking about the latter, you know, there's been significant health cuts. Like I mentioned, there all the CDC programming. I think that's the Maine CDC had to let go, like, you know, a dozen employees or something last week. Title 10, which is funding for non-abortion reproductive health services, that's going to hit all of our reproductive health providers very hard. That, you know, they call it the gag rule. Trump had it implemented during his previous administration. It is back. And I know in Maine, those service providers were already very strapped. And so they're very nervous about the implications of that and then what that will mean for the services that they can provide, especially to lower income people. Like you mentioned, like food assistance, the food banks, there's a key program that, and I'm sure Ryan knows more about this than I do, but you know, allows food banks to purchase produce from local farms, and like a net positive on all sides. And that has been cut. And, you know, for Maine, and probably a lot of other places, all this will be compounded by the fact that our state budget is also facing a deficit. So for all these programs that I'm sure many, many people would like to see continued, I know the legislature is going to be pretty strapped to figure out how they can plug those holes as well. So, you know, I mentioned food assistance, food banks. Then there's like just grant funding in general. So nonprofits, any nonprofit that probably ever used a word like climate or race or LGBTQ has probably had their funding cut, and that will have implications for the programs that they can provide, their staffing, you know, any sub grants that they provide. Yeah, it's just, it keeps going, frankly. And I keep saying, like, I think this is only the start.
The nonprofit sector is a big sector in Maine relative to some other states. So I'm sure that's a disproportionate hit in Maine about the grant funding.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think they were some of the first that were like, this is real.
Yeah. Ryan, talk about the food banks a little bit. Is that part of your constituent matrix?
A bit. We run a program that provides funding, harvest bucks that goes through farmers markets. But we certify a lot of farms that do participate in these Mainers Feeding Mainers and local food procurement programs for schools. And generally that is what we're seeing from the USDA, is that they are targeting food procurement programs that affect local purchasing, essentially small and medium-sized farms. They aren't going after the big industrial commodity ag farms. It's really the small local producers that are being impacted.
Mm. I read your interview in the New Yorker a couple weeks ago, Samuel, and you weren't quite at the point of saying constitutional crisis then. What do you make of it now?
Well, you know, the basic point I was trying to make in that interview was, I think that this term constitutional crisis has taken on a significance that goes way beyond the substance here. And so it's sort of asking everybody to decide, you know, is there this point of no return that we've crossed, when well before any of these points, we've had a really unhealthy constitutional system. You know, we have had a steady erosion of the power of Congress. We have had courts that have granted more and more power to the executive branch. And, you know, we have had a political system that has kind of stood by while that has happened. You know, I think every day there is more concern here. And, you know, if you're asking me, is my hair on fire? My hair has been on fire for a while, but it's much more on fire today than it was a few days ago, and probably will continue to get more on fire until, you know, we see something that reins in these, you know, very aggressive executive actions. I think, again, asserting the power to take someone off the street without due process, send them to another country, and then because you've sent them to another country, deny the courts any power of judicial review, you know, that crosses any line you could imagine. So call it a constitutional crisis, call it an incredible threat to liberty, a threat of tyranny, you know, all that stuff seems to me totally appropriate. But, you know, I think as well, the very aggressive way in which this administration has used the lever of federal funds to try to go after independent sources of authority and in the civil society sector, you know, whether they are nonprofits or universities or
big law
firms, yeah, you know, all of the institutions that might pose a check on this administration's actions, they have gone after very aggressively. You know, it's nice to see that Harvard at least has stood up and said, what you've asked us to do is a violation of First Amendment rights and also violates all of the procedures that Congress set forth for taking away federal funds under Title VI. You know, that's something we've been waiting for a large academic institution to do, and it's really good that they did it. They're totally in the right about this. Obviously, the Trump administration has now escalated, and I'm sure this will be resolved in court, but there's no better institution to fight the Trump administration than Harvard University on this. You know, you've also seen the president get rid of all of the internal checks within the executive branch on the actions of the president and his minions. So firing inspectors general without following the statutorily required procedures, firing the special counsel whose job is to make sure they comply with the Hatch Act, but also protect the rights and interests of civil servants, firing the members of the Merit Systems Protection Board and the National Labor Relations Board, right? All of this is part and parcel of an effort to act with unchecked executive power. And I don't know how you couldn't be concerned about that if you believe in a constitutional democracy.
Yeah. Now, Lauren, have you seen or read or heard that Maine's academic institutions are being threatened by some of these actions? I know we've got our public and our private universities.
Right. None of them were on the initial lists of schools that they had sent these, you know, kind of warning letters to. None of the Maine colleges were there. And the University of Maine system has had its own journey with the Title IX investigations. But so far, no Maine school has really had to, you know, kind of make their choice like Samuel referenced.
Yeah. Who in Maine is speaking up and showing the courage of their convictions? The libraries, Amy, you want to say a word about the posture that your association has taken?
Sure, yeah. So we've been quite active. As soon as we heard, I think it was about 2.5 weeks ago, that the federal agency, the Institute for Museum and Library Services, had been targeted with an executive action, you know, we certainly jumped into action, and our members, I would say Maine librarians, are very active and engaged, and they really did the work to contact our congressional representatives and made phone calls, emails, just really showed up. And we've had quite a bit of success just sharing data and information and talking to the press and making sure it's really in people's awareness. And I think there's so much going on. It's really easy to lose the thread of like how individual sectors are being affected, because the news cycle just, you know, things move on. And so we're really actively trying to keep this in everyone's awareness, because libraries do affect, a lot, that we do serve everyone. And this is a really, we feel, an essential service in Maine and throughout the country.
People love their libraries too. I'm going to take one more station break, and then I want to talk about who's standing up, who's pushing back, and what people can actually do to join the Courage Brigade. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU. This is Ann Luther of the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Samuel Bagenstos, Frank G. Miller Professor of Law at the University of Michigan, Ryan Dennett, Program Director at the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, and Lauren McCauley, editor at the Maine Morning Star, and Amy Weishart, whom you just heard, president of the Maine Library Association. This program was pre-recorded on April 15th. No listener calls are being taken. So, yeah, I mean, the governor is the headliner in terms of pushing back and standing up. And Lauren, you told the story a little bit, but you want to say a little bit more about the governor's stance, and then who else have you read or heard in Maine is taking the courageous posture here?
Yeah, well, Governor Mills has been really clear about her reasoning behind the stance she's taken, that, you know, it's not necessarily about the rights of transgender Mainers, but it's about the right of all Mainers, and it's about sort of upholding state law, which the Maine Human Rights Act includes gender as a protected class.
And when did that pass? And did it pass like by a big majority? I mean, it's not a brand new law.
No. So gender was added, I believe, in 2021. And I don't have like the roll call in my head.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was added. So she's upholding the rule of law, and she says, you know, if any, you know, right now there's calls to remove gender from the main Human Rights Act, which we saw happen in Iowa. I think that was the first time that like a protected class had been removed. But, you know, her argument is like, it's not going to stop there, is what she says. And so, you know, she's asserting, you know, her belief that like the state law protects this. So in addition to Mills, you know, we saw tens of thousands of Mainers take to the streets on April 5th. I was surprised at how big that showing was, to be honest. You know, I live in Biddeford, Maine, and every Friday, there's probably 100 people outside of Susan Collins' office here. And I know we're not the only community that's happening in. I know there's like a small, mighty group in Waterville that protests outside the Tesla charging station every Tuesday. Like, there's all sorts of these little actions that were kind of providing, I think, a drumbeat, if you will, for the big action earlier this month. I know the unions have been doing kind of a lot of work in terms of publicly opposing the Trump administration. You know, they've had protests outside of, you know, postal service. That's another potential cut, post offices, and, you know, various press conferences. You know, having press conferences with Social Security workers who are worried about office closures and people having trouble doing constituent services. So yeah, those are the ones that come to mind. The unions have really been active, as well as, I think, really just like grassroots groups have been pretty activated right now.
I saw Sean McGarvey of the Construction Workers Union made, I may not get that title correct, but made quite a strong statement yesterday in favor of Abrego Garcia. Did you see that, Samuel?
I did see that, you know, and I think one of the things that we've seen here is, you know, Abrego Garcia is, as I understand it, a union member, and you know, you have folks showing solidarity for him as a union worker. I think it's incredibly important that we have a broad swath of civil society standing up for due process and the rule of law here. You know, that's just fundamental. And, you know, I think having people putting pressure on the members of Congress to do more, to say more, is also incredibly important. I think, you know, around the country, these town halls that people are showing up at, and when members of Congress are canceling their town halls because they don't want to hear the anger, you know, shadow town halls are being held, and you have just an incredible outpouring of people who are really not happy with what's going on and looking for someone who is going to stand up. You know, I think a number of attorneys general have done a lot. Your attorney general in Maine, our attorney general in Michigan, a number have. But, you know, I think folks are really looking for leadership from Congress on this. And I think that's ultimately, or, you know, in the medium term, where a lot of the pressure is going to be focused. And people are obviously looking ahead to next year's elections. But I think for a lot of folks, that's way too late to stop the very significant harm that's happening to basic institutions of government, to people who rely on government, to, you know, farmers, to Head Start programs around the country, to rural hospitals. You know, we have a measles epidemic that is going on right now. We have HIV funding being dramatically cut and people being put at risk for that. There are just so many very acute concerns that really can't wait for an election cycle to play out.
So how would you advise our listeners? Like, what should people be doing right now after they hear this show? Anybody have a thought?
I'll kick it off. You know, as I mentioned, it's so hard to track, you know, which of these cuts are sticking, who's getting hit the hardest. So, I mean, for me as a member of the media, I think that I would love to hear more from directly impacted people. You know, like, if you are getting cut or, you know, experiencing firings or having that check not arrive or what have you, I think it's important to share those stories. That's the only way that we find out that anything's happening. And I think that helps people understand that, you know, what's happening in D.C. is actually hitting home.
You know, like we talked about at the beginning of the show, the institutions and the nonprofits that serve these communities have trouble stepping forward. But the individuals themselves who are being hurt can tell their personal stories. If they were going to do that, Lauren, where would they go with that?
Oh, info@mainmorningstar.com would be the way to do it.
Okay. Amy, what would you say? I know library patrons are a pretty loyal bunch and have probably been rallying to your side here. What would you say about your people?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, we have a lot of really dedicated library users throughout Maine. And our current initiative right now, we're starting, as Lauren actually mentioned, we are collecting stories as well. So we're asking people to share their impact stories of using the library, what the library means to them, how it impacts their everyday life. And that's especially powerful coming from the public. So we have a web form that's up now, and we're hoping to use those stories to share with Congress, to share with various constituencies as we move forward with whatever form advocacy takes in terms of the next steps.
Ryan, you're probably collecting farmer stories too. You alluded to some earlier on the show. Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. We have been collecting farmer stories and also encourage people to reach out directly to the delegation. They also want to hear directly what those stories are. And we have a policy newsletter if people want to keep up to date on how farmers are being impacted and what they can do to support them.
Is it a place to sign up for that?
Yes, just on the MAFCA website, MAFCA.org.
Okay. So Samuel, do these rallies and protests help, do you think?
They absolutely do. You know, I think that in the early days of this administration, a lot of people made the comment that they weren't seeing the outpouring of opposition that we'd seen in the first Trump administration. And, you know, there wasn't the Women's March on the second day of the administration in the same way. But really, if you look at the number of protests around the country and the number of people participating, I think we've gotten past where we were at this stage in the first Trump administration. It's more that the political leaders are a little bit behind the people here, that I think they saw the outcome of the first Trump election as sort of a fluke. And so they were ready to be oppositional from day one. And they were a little bit caught on the back foot from the second Trump election. I think they're now seeing both the combination of Trump being incredibly aggressive in blowing through any limitations on executive power and the people really beginning to stand up, that is giving courage to a lot of the political leaders. The leaders are not really leading, they're following here, but that's incredibly important that people stand up and show the politicians what they want and what they care about, and that's going to make a big difference.
All right, we're running out of time this afternoon. I promised you each a minute or two to give your final thoughts on this topic, and we have time for you to take at least a minute or two. So I'll go to you first, Ryan. How does this look from a farmer's perspective, and what's the message that you would like our listeners to take away from the conversation?
It just feels like the past 5 years have shown us how fragile our local food system is and how important it is, both for access to food, local economies, preservation of wide open spaces and natural resources. And so I want to make sure the public is aware that, you know, we have these threats coming at farmers on top of everything else and the tight margins that they're operating with. And so I think it's really important to support our local farmers, both directly as much as we can through purchasing local food, but also speaking out on their behalf. And we're really excited. We've seen a lot of the momentum from the April 5th rally, and we're actually hosting a rally in Augusta tomorrow. And farmers are so excited that they're actually driving their tractors to Augusta. So it does feel like there's momentum building and people getting ready to speak out. So I look forward to seeing more of that.
We didn't talk about PFAS at all. And is that being hit here?
The University of Maine in particular has received a lot of federal funding for PFAS research. And so again, all federal funding feels a bit uncertain at this time. We're lucky that Maine really cares about PFAS, and we also have the state funded. MAFCA was just awarded a grant to do some PFAS research. And once again, it seems like the organic farmers in this state were the first to speak up about that. And they're really trying to draw attention to the federal impacts that are happening to farmers all across Maine as well.
Good thing. Final thoughts, Amy, wrap it up in terms of what you'd like our listeners to take away today.
One thing I wanted to mention is I was one of about a dozen people who last week went up to the State House to testify in support of proposed legislation to establish a working group to study libraries throughout Maine. And we presented to the Education and Cultural Affairs Committee. And I was really struck by how many library staff and then patrons testified all in support of this bill about just how much libraries do for people. It's not just books. It's not just electronic resources, although those are very important. It's building a sense of community. It's providing access. Some libraries are serving really vulnerable populations who just don't have access to social services that they need. So there is so much embedded in what libraries do, and eroding the support system for libraries throughout Maine has a cascading effect and really a ripple effect throughout the state. So I just encourage everyone to continue to speak out, talk to the congressional delegation, do what you can, because this is all really important, and libraries serve everyone.
And I'm really struck by what you say about community cohesion and shared institutions and the degrading of those eroding our public life. So thank you for that comment. Lauren?
I know a lot of people, like people I know personally, who are pretty overwhelmed by the news and really inclined to check out right now. And I think that, you know, everyone is welcome to do that. But I've got a small, mighty team that's been pretty dedicated to reporting on, you know, what's happening and the impacts of Maine every day. And we're available without a paywall. And then part of our partner organization, we have a DC bureau that's tracking very closely what's going on there. So if you do decide to read the news, we are available and here for you.
Thank you so much, Lauren. Samuel, last word to you.
Well, I just think it's really important for people to stay engaged and to, you know, be learning about what's going on, what the impacts are. We talk about this in terms of constitutional democracy being under threat, but that sounds very abstract. You know, concretely, what we're talking about is that farmers are losing out on money that they have contracted for. And so they're being put under threat. That, you know, we're talking about people losing out on school breakfast and lunch programs, food banks being cut off, you know, important health programs being cut off. And people need to engage with that. People need to put pressure on their legislators to stand up on this. But also, people need to help support the folks in their communities who need help, because the federal money that was supposed to go to them is not going to them. And the federal programs that were supposed to work are breaking down under the stress of so many people being really precipitously and unlawfully fired in those programs. That's the way we maintain our democracy, when we come together both to fight for the policies we want and come together to support the people who are in our communities.
Thank you so much, all of you. That's our show for today. Our guests this afternoon were Samuel Bagenstos, the Frank G. Millard Professor of Law at the University of Michigan, Ryan Dennett, the Program Director at the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, Lauren McCauley, Editor at the Maine Morning Star, and Amy Weishart, President of the Maine Library Association. You can find links to their respective organizations and their bios on our website. That's lwvme.org. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. We're streaming at WERU.org. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@WERU.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to learn about other shows in this series. You can subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next month.